Thanks for listening to this podcast. I'm Bob Kinzel, co-host of Vermont Edition. Just wanted to let you know that this has been edited for brevity. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. The COVID-19 pandemic has certainly changed the way that the legislature considers important issues facing the state. Because they can't meet in person at the State House any longer for health and safety reasons, the House and Senate and their committees are using Zoom technology to review proposed legislation. But some people are concerned that this remote system of governance has some serious drawbacks and that it also limits public participation in the democratic process. Lawmakers are meeting this month in a rare September session to work on a number of issues, including the state budget, Act 250 reform, a tax and regulate marijuana plan, and to consider more money for the Vermont State Colleges. Today on Vermont Edition, we've got a great group of reporters to update us on many of these critical issues. With us today, VPR's John Dillon, Xander Landon from VT Digger, and also Calvin Cutler from WCAX-TV. It's great to have you all on the program today.
Hi, Bob.
Great to be here. Hey, Bob.
Let me just start asking all three of you about how your job as a reporter has changed since the middle of March when lawmakers went home because of the pandemic. I know usually you're up at the State House for a good chunk of the day, patrolling the halls, looking for stories, gathering information. Now it seems very, very different. How has your life as a legislative reporter changed? John, how about for you?
Well, everything about it has changed. I mean, the State House itself is closed. We all remember that day in March when the side doors were shuttered and the signs went up. I think what's changed, you have to talk about what's changed for the people in the building or people who were in the building. And it seems that's more important than what's changed for me. But for the politicians, it's got to be so different. These are all extroverted, they ran for office. They love talking to people. And now they're looking at a computer screen with Zoom panes, panels, and it's just not the same. The give and take, this beehive of activity, the cafeteria where everything, gets hashed out. For the public, I think it's a severe disadvantage for people who want to get involved, and we can talk more about that. But you really don't have the opportunity contemporaneously to weigh in on issues. For us, I think, we can go back through the videos and we can get stuff that we may not have been able to get all at once previously. So, you can rewind the YouTube videos. That's great. But you don't get any of the flavor of the place. So I think that's – and you don't really see, the political activity, the give and take, the who's talking to whom and where deals are being cut. That's just – it's all being done probably through text and phone calls.
And right. Xander, what do you think? How have things changed for you?
Well, I think it's, like John said, just not being and being able to be in the room and being able to sort of observe in person does inhibit, I guess, from a journalistic perspective, your ability to easily clarify or talk about the policies that are being considered and discussed with the people in the room while they're there. You have to put a lot of calls out and hope that people call you back. You can't, corner the public officials like you used to be able to in normal times. So that's definitely somewhat of a disadvantage. Sometimes it can be a little bit harder to get that sort of clarification or to do follow-up interviews. I think in some ways you could argue that in terms of being able to access the information, access the sort of what is going on in the room, in the rooms themselves, the Zoom rooms themselves, I guess you could say, maybe more people than normally could have been watching or observing can now do so because it's all being streamed on YouTube. Previously, I'm not sure exactly how it worked, but ORCA, public access TV would be in committee rooms and they'd be filming, but they wouldn't be in all the committee rooms. They would be in sort of select ones, sort of depending on the issues that were being discussed. So now all committee rooms are all, you know, all legislative discussions are recorded and archived and accessible. I think that's probably an upshot, a positive of what's going on, at least, you know, anyone that wants to view what's been going on in the legislature can do so, and it's all up there in on the web.
Now, Calvin, you're a television reporter. This has got to be a tough situation for you.
Right. I mean, through the whole pandemic, I've been saying that, you know, Zoom is death for television. I mean, it's tough to, you know, we're in TV. I mean, it's very visual. We have to be in the committee rooms, in the Senate, in the House. You know, it really gives a flavor to the public of and showing what lawmakers are doing. But now that it's all virtual, it's pretty tough for television. Like Xander and John both said, I mean, hundreds of people are, you know, viewing these YouTube videos, which is great. But at times, as Xander said, if you need to have like a follow-up question or a clarifying point, or, you know, even if you just want to talk to somebody off the record and say, hey, how is this bill doing, or how are you feeling about this? That disconnect is it's pretty evident. So that's definitely a setback as well. And also, media isn't the only one that's been having setbacks as well. Lobbyists, they've, of course, you know, play an important role in representing a lot of businesses and organizations throughout the state. They've almost been shut out from the process entirely. So I know that they've been struggling as well. So the legislature has been doing as best as they can, and you really have to hand it to the legislative staff that they were able to prop this system up so quickly, because it is quite intense and it is quite complicated, you know, propping up this digital system where 180 plus members of the legislature can interact with each other all on the same platform. So it's an interesting issue, and we'll see, you know, how it pans out this session and potentially next session as well.
John, you mentioned that perhaps some lawmakers aren't overly thrilled with this current situation. They really don't have any options, but it's not quite the experience that they thought they were going to have inside the State House itself. Now, as they look ahead to January of 2021, what are their options?
Not very good ones. They just heard about a study where they hired an architect to look at space issues, and they got a report on Tuesday about that. And it's interesting. The only space big enough for 180 people with the and the architect used 7 feet, thinking that, you know, how we're supposed to be all 6 feet apart. But he said, well, we actually take up a foot of space. So he plotted out where all those people could be, and the Barry Auditorium was the choice, potentially. The Senate conceivably could be in the building, but that didn't go over too well when the Chairman Joe Banning of the Institutions Committee in the Senate said, oh, well, we can be here, you know, and the House doesn't have to be here. And House members were saying, well, you know, we are a co-equal branch and we all should be on the same footing. So there are no really good options for the entire body to be together, because it's, you know, the State House, you're all on top of each other in that place. I don't know how you would physically distance. As a member of the public, certainly. I mean, you just wouldn't have the access that you have, that you had. And as I mentioned, that's been really tough for people who have wanted to get involved. You know, you just lose that contemporaneous aspect of being able to look somebody in the eye and say, hey, can we talk about this? I want to testify. I mean, that happened yesterday in a Senate committee where people who wanted to testify, it would have been worked out normally, you know, in just a matter of minutes, I think, in person. But instead, it was emails, texts, and ruffled feelings. So as to the space issue, you know, Barry Auditorium, maybe we'll be doing this from Barry next year. I don't know.
We are also looking at some of the issues facing lawmakers in the next month or so. If you have some thoughts on those issues, give us a call. We'd love to hear from you today at 1-800-639-2211. Tax and regulate marijuana could be up. There's a global warming bill, Act 250. 1-800-639-2211. Xander, another big issue is the budget. Now, lawmakers, if I remember correctly, and it's easy to lose track of these things, passed a budget for the first quarter of the 2021 fiscal year, but now they're coming back to look at the next 9 months. At one point, they were looking at a pretty big budget gap, but have things gotten better?
Things have gotten better over time, and I think part of that has to do with the fact that, you know, COVID maybe hasn't hit Vermont as hard as economists had thought it might. Initially, back in April or May, we were looking at a $400 million budget gap for this year, $400 million in tax revenue that had previously been expected, that was projected to evaporate amid the COVID-19 crisis. And when lawmakers got the latest projections back in August, that had almost, that had been reduced by more than half. It's about $180 million now. And, there was talk sort of, hearing about all this potential sort of revenue loss about having to really cut and slash in this budget, really look at reducing sort of programs, government programs, maybe even cutting state employee jobs. And the governor was able to put together a budget with the new revenue forecast that really doesn't have to rely on those sort of more draconian measures. He was able to put together a budget that really keeps most social services that are essential to the state intact. And that's because largely the state saw a big surplus back in July when tax revenue from 2019 came in. When people were paying their income taxes, which had been delayed from an April deadline to a July deadline. And that's because, 2019 was a pretty good year for the economy. COVID-19 had not yet hit. So there was about $110 million in surplus money that could be used for this budget. And then a lot of other factors came into play. The federal government increased the amount it gives states for Medicaid funding, which actually ended up, giving Vermont about $40 million in additional money to use. And then, the state had already taken steps to sort of reduce spending by putting a freeze on hiring of state employees, et cetera. So a lot of these factors together made it so that the budget came out, pretty even. There was less need to make these major cuts than had been discussed or projected a few months ago. So now it's up to the legislature to go through, and they're doing this right now, go through the governor's proposal. There are a few areas of disagreement, but overall, they've got 3 weeks to do this, and they've got a lot to accomplish in three weeks, but it is much less of a dire picture than it once was.
Calvin, one of the more pressing budget issues involves funding for the Vermont State College System. The system has had some serious financial problems caused by a reduction in students, certainly the impact of the pandemic. Where do things stand now for the state colleges in this budget year?
Right. So as we all know, the state college system is facing about a $30 million shortfall. Lawmakers earlier this year, they promised bridge funding. This all comes after, of course, the previous chancellor floated a proposal to close several of the campuses, and that was met with a huge outcry, and that led to him stepping down. So now we're just sort of trying to figure out what is the path forward to make the Vermont State College system sustainable. There's been a few proposals of using some of the $1.25 billion CARES Act funds that we got from the federal government. There's some $200 million of that left that the legislature has been holding on to. But as of right now, federal guidelines say that we can't use that money. The expenses have to be directly for COVID-19, whether that be for, hazard pay for essential medical workers or, PPE in schools, that sort of thing. So in the meantime, though, while they're searching for these funding mechanisms, there is a task force that's working to find redundancies within the Vermont State College system and try to put together a plan of, how can we make this sustainable? There's a number of things that they're looking at, one of them potentially scaling back the chancellor's office, maybe reducing some space. Again, lawmakers and Vermont State College system leaders. They're working on that, but that report won't be out until the spring, if I'm not mistaken. So we're kind of in a tough situation right now where, you know, the state college system needs money, but we don't know if we'll be able to give them this money. And as of right now, the future is unclear, but lawmakers have stressed that, you know, this is a priority.
Let's go to our callers and talk to Stephen, who's calling from Montpelier. Hi, Stephen. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Bob. Thanks. I've got a couple of observations regarding the impediments to citizen participation. Montpelier, as you know, has had two police shootings in as many years. And so there was a joint government operations and judiciary committee hearings, public hearings, using this remote technology. And I wrote to the staff and said, I won't have the bandwidth. Can you give me a call-in number so I can listen into the hearing or participate at a particular time? And everyone assumed that you had web access and could participate and or watch on YouTube. So that hearing came and went before anybody realized that I was locked out of a hearing that has direct bearing on Montpelier police reform. Secondly, just 2 days ago, Senate Finance was holding a hearing from the Commissioner of Public Service on broadband of all issues. And there was not sufficient bandwidth to use YouTube. And so I asked just for the ability to listen in via telephone. And sorry, we can't give you that number. And so I believe there's a need for the legislature to take seriously the issues. It's ironic that the legislative IT plan, which could have, would have, should have anticipated this type of emergency, has not been written in 12 years, similar to the 10-year telecommunications plan. So when we write statutes that require planning and then we ignore them and they come back to haunt us, there's apparently no accountability at all. So
all right, Stephen, you raised a very important issue, John. We know of broadband access across the state and how it is limited, very limited in some areas. That makes it difficult for people to access this technology if they want to follow what's happening at the statehouse.
Absolutely. I mean, I don't know why a phone number to call in shouldn't be made available along with a web address to view it. You should be able to listen in, and you know they have the technology to keep you muted until you know you're called upon if you're a witness. So it seems that seems fairly easy to fix. I think the bigger issue for citizens is a bigger issue for citizens. As I was saying, is just the ability to have an interaction with lawmakers while the debate is happening or the testimony is required. You know, you're physically not in the room, so you can't just say, "Hey, I'm here. Can we just can we go outside and talk about this for a second so I can get on the agenda?" You know, all of that. We took for granted is no longer there, and it's I don't know the answer besides the phone number issue. I don't know how to resolve that outside of being just generally more open to the public to being able to testify.
Well, there's a tax and regulate marijuana bill being considered by lawmakers. The House and Senate seem to have some areas of agreement and some areas where they really disagree. Xander, can you update us on where this bill stands?
Sure. It's basically what you just said. There, you know, this bill has been in the works for a couple of years. We already have legal possession and limited cultivation of marijuana in the state, but we don't have any way for folks to, businesses to come in and legally sell the product. So this legislation would do that, but there's also been a bunch of, there are a lot of other considerations that lawmakers are making as they consider whether they want to allow dispensaries to open up and, considerations they're making about policies related to roadway safety in particular have become kind of contentious as lawmakers are debating. And so the House, for example, wants to see roadside saliva testing legalized if we legalize a market for cannabis. And those tests are controversial and opposed in the Senate, because while those tests can detect marijuana in a driver's system, they can't actually determine whether you're impaired at the time that they're given. So there are some civil liberties concerns that the Senate has with that legislation and the House that measure, and the House wants to see that measure, and the governor also wants to see that measure if this bill passes. Another big piece that is causing some disagreement is a measure that would make it so that police can pull drivers over if they suspect they're not wearing a seatbelt. And this has been a policy that the House wants to pass, has wanted to pass for years, and the Senate has opposed for years as well, because they're concerned about, once again, civil liberties concerns and giving police another reason to pull people over. And they're concerned that this could lead to, you know, an increase in the number of minority people of color who are pulled over by police. So these are two big sticking points. And the House is expected to give a counter proposal, sort of trying to meet the Senate in the middle on these issues and other issues as well on Friday. Another big issue related to in this bill that, you know, that the House and Senate disagree on is local control as it relates to marijuana and where these shops can set up if they're allowed to. So the House wants to make it so that towns have to vote in affirmation to approve shops in towns before they can set up. That's called opt-in. The Senate wants to make it so that towns can opt out, but that in general, it's legal without a vote for dispensaries to come in and set up. There's also disagreements, differences on the tax rate at which the Senate and the House want to tax marijuana. And sort of embedded in all of this is the governor and where he stands. The governor has signaled that, you know, he's okay with a legal market for cannabis, but there are concerns he has as well. He also wants to see roadside saliva testing and significant funding for education, drug use prevention education measures if this is legalized.
Calvin, Zander just outlined a number of areas between the House and Senate where there seem to be some pretty strong disagreements. What do you think? Is this bill going to make it across the finish line by the end of September, or is it just going to have to be reintroduced in January?
You know, Bob, it's a great question. I think it depends on who you talk to. I mean, there's an astounding amount of political will to get this passed because it, of course, is going to take several years to roll out this system. The legislature's joint fiscal office says in fiscal year 23, when this would be rolled out, we'd receive about anywhere from $2 to $3.5 million in tax revenue. So there's certainly a bit of lot of political will behind it, but it's just a matter of whether the two sides can come together. Some people I talk with say, you know, this will pass. You know, we need this now. We need the money. Others say these are non-starters, and these sticking points really they'll take it to the grave.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Philip in Essex. Hi, Philip. Welcome to the program.
Hi, I'm wondering if there's been any discussion about moving legislators to any of the state buildings next door. We hear that there's a lot of state workers that are working from home. Is there any space in some of those other buildings, whether it be the DMV or any of the other buildings adjacent that the legislature could be in? And I'm also curious, is the legislature looking to solve this long term, or are they just trying to find a place until COVID is no longer an issue?
John, the number of state employees in Montpelier and other places across the state is really, there are a lot of people working remotely. What about Philip's idea of using some of this vacant space?
Yeah, the report looks at that. There's not the big space outside of the Barry Auditorium for the whole assembly to be together, but there are, the report said, a lot of conference rooms. Committees could meet in various places around Montpelier and be physically distant. including space in Waterbury at the state office complex there. So that is an option, but not for the body as a whole. And as for, you know, long term, no, I don't think they want to replace the Vermont State House with some other site. I think this is all stemming from the current emergency and the physical distancing requirements.
Xander, I wanted to go back to the tax and regulate bill for just a second. Is there some tension between folks who want to make sure that small growers in Vermont have some sort of competitive position with what the some advocates refer to as big weed?
There sure is. There are a lot of people that don't like the way that this bill is laid out and that they don't think that it provides small growers with enough of an opportunity or an avenue to getting involved in the marketplace. And there are also folks who say that the bill doesn't do enough to address racial justice issues related to racial justice. And the criminal justice system in response to this legislation. They want to see more provisions that will assure that minority-owned marijuana businesses will be prioritized in the market, and that there will be more, you know, avenues for people of color to get involved in this market. So there is, you know, I think lawmakers are hearing those concerns, particularly surrounding the racial justice issues. There's a big push now to basically expand to. Really expand the state's expungement of marijuana charges, misdemeanor charges for possession of marijuana, and there are, you know, likely thousands of those on the books from years, you know, the last few decades, and there's a proposal that would essentially make it so that those records, misdemeanor marijuana possessions. Records are automatically expunged, and it would also increase the amount that of marijuana that people can legally possess in the state from 1 ounce to 2 ounces. So, you know, that was sort of the main provision that we've seen come out since a lot of the groups that have opposed this bill made clear once again a few weeks ago that they don't think this is the right policy for the state.
John?
Well, just on the racial justice aspect, it's there's a strong argument to be made against the House provision or House insistence that primary enforcement of seatbelt laws be part of this bill. There's a racial justice aspect to that because, as we know from studies from the state police on and other police agencies, people of color get stopped more. They get searched more. You give police another opportunity to stop someone, and it's going to redound more to people of color. And that point was raised by Joe Banning, who's on the conference committee and is a criminal defense lawyer. He said, you know, that goes in the wrong direction for where we want to be headed right now.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to James, who's calling from Leicester. Hey, James, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'm hearing all this hand-wringing about how there's no room for all the legislators to meet, given the requirement to keep six feet of distance and so on and so forth. I don't hear any discussion about reducing the size of government. I'm not a Republican. But under these circumstances, I'm wondering why we are not talking about cutting the legislature by half. There must be a formula for this that would take effect quite quickly. The legislature has the power to do this, I believe.
James, are you suggesting that the 150 members of the House be reduced to 75 and the 30 members of the Senate be reduced to 15, for instance?
Yes. I could be wrong,
but I think it's going to take a constitutional amendment to make that happen. But we can maybe get some information on that. But I do believe it would take a constitutional amendment to make that happen. Let's talk to Jennifer, who is calling from Worcester. Hi, Jennifer. Welcome to the program.
Hey. Thank you so much. Thank you. Yeah, driving through New Hampshire and Vermont right now.
I'm Hello? Sorry, we couldn't. Yes. Hey, Jennifer, what's your question today?
So I actually have a comment, and I would love to get some feedback from you guys and everybody. me, my partner, and myself, we both got involved. We work in the cannabis industry in Massachusetts. And I'm a graduate of Clark University's graduate certificate of cannabis regulatory affairs. I was one of the first graduates. It's the first program like it in the country. So, and I'm no expert. You know, I'm not trying to come on the show or anything like that. But, and you know, my story is I got into cannabis because I want more research for and more empowerment for people who are choosing to use it recreationally. And for the, you know, the space to use it medically. How, you know, where are the people in Vermont in terms of, you know, this being legal and nothing still happening because of DUIC, driving under the influence of cannabis? Who's looking at the data out of Colorado and all of the other states that have legalized and looking at the negligible numbers, the data, the cold hard facts, that there are no issues with driving under the influence of cannabis.
Well, Jennifer, let's see. Xander, you know, it's interesting that different states approach the whole impairment issue differently. Are there any models that Vermont lawmakers are looking at, perhaps in Colorado, to address this issue?
I know that, you know, in Colorado, for example, they did increase the number of drug recognition experts that are, you know, on the roads at the time, you know, when they legalized cannabis. I think that there are some people in the Senate who would prefer that as a method of sort of addressing the roadway driving concerns that are related to legalizing cannabis. It is really interesting. I mean, I'd have to take another hard look at the data about impaired driving to provide any insight about, you know, to what extent that data would show that there's, you know, legalization leads to an increase in impaired driving. But it certainly is one of the biggest sort of sticking points or sort of barriers addressing this issue to getting this policy across the finish line in the state. I mean, the governor has made very clear and the House has made very clear that there are real concerns about how this would increase the number of impaired drivers in the state or would sort of necessitate taking action to prevent high driving, whether it's through, you know, a lot of additional spending on educational measures to prevent, you know, youth usage. And certainly, as you know, we've already discussed a bunch of law enforcement measures to give police additional powers to sort of enforce the law as it relates to impaired driving. But certainly, drug recognition experts and you know, saliva testing are things that, you know, lawmakers have been looking at to address this.
Calvin, one bill I wanted to discuss today before the program is over is this Global Warming Solutions Act, something that was originally passed in the House and considered in the Senate. It's got some controversy to it. What exactly does this bill do, and what's the outlook for this legislation?
Right, Bob. So as you may know, the Global Warming Solutions Act, it basically sets Vermont up with the Paris Climate Accord by reducing our greenhouse gases by 2050. But the real controversial point is that it will hold the state liable, legally liable, if the state does not meet those carbon goals. So that's been one of the biggest concerns from multiple groups, from House leadership, or from Republican House leadership, and also Governor Phil Scott. Now, Democrats, of course, have said that this is imperative and we really need to take action on the Global Warming Solutions Act, especially after, if you may remember back in the fall, we saw many protests across the country and in Montpelier, you know, demanding action be taken on climate change. So there certainly is, I can see progress being made on this bill, but there's still a lot of concerns that top administration officials have and that Governor Scott has. So we'll have to see how it pans out in the coming weeks.
John, as we look at this bill, I want to see if I understand some of the basic outlines of it correctly. Tell me if I'm right on this. Does the bill establish some levels for CO2 emission reductions over the next 5, 10, 20 years? And at the same time, it gives citizens the ability to bring a lawsuit if those levels are not met, but the lawsuit would not be for monetary damages, but to force the government into action?
Yeah, it's an enforcement mechanism, and that is a point of contention, and the governor certainly doesn't like that. There's also an appropriations on it, or there was. The Senate took the money out. The House has about $1 million in there. The bill is actually on the House floor today, but I'm told it's going to the House Energy and Technology Committee for their consideration. You know, they've got to look at the Senate amendments. I would say this one, it's looking to me like veto bait, but I could be wrong because of those two provisions, both the money and the legal. Well, actually, three issues probably that the governor might object to: the lawsuit part of it, and then the sort of the delegation of the powers to a climate council instead of agencies, state agencies. So that's been an issue that people have raised as well, is that we're letting this council do what state government should be doing. Of course, the other argument is, well, they haven't done it so far, so let's figure out a better way. But I don't know. I don't think this thing is necessarily going to make it past the governor's desk.
Xander, it's interesting. This does set up reductions in emissions, 26% reductions below 2005 levels by 2025, 40% below 1990 levels by 2030, and 80% reduction below 1990 levels by 2050. But at the same time, what we've found is that emissions in recent years, even with all the talk about this, there's data from 2015 that shows that carbon emissions have actually increased in Vermont during this time period, showing the difficulty perhaps of taking steps to make this bill effective.
Yeah, definitely. And I think what John just said about this climate council presents a big concern for the governor, and a lot of Republicans in the House and Senate have raised it as well. It really wouldn't be lawmakers deciding how we actually cut emissions with the steps that we take, whether it's, consumer measures related to driving, measures related to, just how we cut the amount of fuel we're burning, et cetera. That would be up to this state panel, and there's some discomfort there with delegating that power to an appointed panel. Obviously, the legislature would, have to eventually approve what they recommend, but it wouldn't be really on the onus of the legislature to come up with the ideas for reducing the carbon emissions. And the governor is also, like John said, been concerned about this aspect of lawsuits. Having the government's sort of time and money be wrapped up in dealing with lawsuits related to if the state fails to meet these goals. But then on the other side, the Democrats that are sort of pushing this legislation forward say this is the only way that we're actually going to follow through with our emissions reduction goals. We need to have a way to hold the government accountable to meeting them. We need to have a provision that allows citizens or groups to take the state to court if it's not doing this work.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Thomas, who's calling from Montpelier. Hi, Thomas. Welcome to the program.
Well, hello, and thank you for having me on. And I would like to go back a little bit to the discussion on public access to the legislature and committees. And one of the things I found is that it can be difficult for ordinary people, the people who are not paid to be in the room, to gain access to Zoom hearings in order to have an influence on legislation. It's just, as you reporters probably are aware, it's quite different having to get in on a Zoom room conversation than it is to just walk into a committee room and have interactions and have the ability to raise one's hand if one has relevant comments. And the other thing is, this is an awkward time to have a legislative session. It's the summer. And people are so busy with the end of summer things, getting ready for back to school, that it also inhibits public access because people are so tied up at a time that they're not expecting to have to be interacting with the legislature.
Thomas, you raised a lot of good issues. I'm sure if lawmakers had their druthers that this is not the way that they would have planned things out there. But you raised some very good questions about public access. John, how does that work?
Well, it doesn't work very well. And I did get a message while we were talking here that from a state official who says, you know, the issue of phone numbers, phone access to these committee meetings, he says that phone number access and you know, providing that number is a requirement for public bodies who are doing hearings outside of the legislature. So if that's the case, it seems like it should be for lawmakers as well.
We're almost out of time. Calvin, could you very briefly tell us what the issues are in Act 250 reform and the outlook for that bill?
Sure, of course, Bob. So Act 250 is, we all know, is Vermont's landmark land use law. People frequently refer to it as the DNA of Vermont. It's the reason that, you know, Vermont is so green and beautiful and we don't have, you know, shopping plazas everywhere. But in recent years, it's become kind of controversial. And so on the 50th anniversary, lawmakers have been looking to update it and bring it up to speed. You know, there's been a few points in it, you know, about protecting, you know, forest health and also recreational trails like mountain bike trails, for instance. You know, back in the 70s when Act 250 was signed into law, they didn't have those. So there's been some discussion, but lawmakers are really taking their time with this one, and they want to be very deliberate in how they move forward with reforming Act 250, because decisions that they make today, they may not see the effects of those decisions for 5, 10, or 15 years down the line. So there's that, and then, of course, there's also these 9 district environmental commissions. The Scott administration and environmental groups, they came to an agreement back in the spring before COVID, before we left the State House, but that deal fell apart. So now we're just sort of taking it one step at a time, really. And I don't see this passing this session, but certainly lawmakers are continuing to make progress to bring this up to up to date.
John, got about a minute left. This has been a huge priority for both the House and Senate Natural Resources Committee. Your thoughts about its passing in the next few weeks?
Well, I don't think it will. It ran into some trouble yesterday in Senate Finance over fees. There are additional fees required, bill back requirements in the bill that would allow agencies to collect fees, which would be needed to pay for the work that the additional Act 250 requirements would necessitate. And I'm hearing it's sort of back to the basics. Maybe they'll just do a forest fragmentation piece, but whether and maybe the downtowns, recall that the bill would have eased, would have eliminated Act 250 review for projects in downtowns if these downtowns were designated under the state's programs. And that now may be in trouble. So it's trying to hash this out. This is a classic case of trying to hash out these complicated things in an abbreviated session where you really aren't and, you know, can't negotiate in person. I think some of these issues are coming to a head around this bill.
It's been a fascinating discussion of many of the issues coming before lawmakers this month. That's it for our program today. Many thanks to our panel, Calvin Cutler of WCAX-TV, Xander Landon of VT Digger, and VPR's John Dillon. Thanks very much for taking the time to be with us today.
Thanks, Bob.